On this week's 51%, we explore the LGBTQ community in relation to a legacy wall in Illinois and an LGBTQ studies class in California.
It's hard to feel empowered when you feel alone in what's going on in with your struggle specifically and with your friends' struggles.
And we meet the film director of Big Stone Gap. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. First, we head to Springfield, Illinois, where the Legacy Wall recently debuted. The first of its kind exhibit tells the history of LGBTQ people. That acronym stands for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer. The man behind the project has made an effort to ensure that lesbians especially don't go without recognition. According to some experts, that's a problem when it comes to LGBTQ representation in mainstream culture. Rachel Otwell tells us more.
I'm standing in the Illinois State Library, just a stone's throw away from the State House in Springfield. Two people are putting up information about gay and lesbian figures. They're attaching posters with Velcro to a large freestanding wall. The installation features pictures and bios of leaders in the worlds of politics, art, and science, ones whose sexuality either went unmentioned or made them unmentionable.
Or when in doubt, I always put a woman up instead of a man because history is so male dominant.
That's Victor Salvo, the man behind the project. He's directing volunteer Jen Zayas. He's telling her how he wants to make sure women are featured prominently on the wall. Zayas says she's taken time out of her career as a graphic designer and singer in Chicago to work on the project because she's an ally for her many LGBTQ friends.
It's really important to me. They have a representation in culture and in history that has been well researched and is accurate because many GLBT people have been basically redacted from all history, their contributions. And so when Victor started doing this, so much of this stuff, most of this stuff, I had no idea. I knew some of the people like Sally Ride, Lorraine Hansberry, I knew who they were, I knew what they could, but I had no idea they were in the GLBT community.
Salvo says this is part of the reason he started what's called the Legacy Project.
For the Legacy Project in general, the actual idea came to pass over 28 years ago at the National March on Washington for Gay and Lesbian Civil Rights in 1987. A variety of things happened at that time that really got us all thinking about our place in history and our role in history and the fact that we knew nothing about people like ourselves. And it started us contemplating what would actually be required to create a project that would make this history accessible for people who were too afraid to go to libraries to look up the titles.
One of Salvo's previous efforts put up permanent plaques about gay figures along Halsted Street in the heart of Chicago's Boys Town. The new wall is portable so it can travel to schools and show LGBTQ students positive examples of people like themselves. Growing up, Salvo says his sexual orientation made him feel isolated and depressed. He even had numerous suicide attempts. His decision to include many women is one that Heather Dell greatly appreciates. She's a lesbian and has taught women in gender studies for 3 decades and now works at the University of Illinois in Springfield.
I think it's enormously important. Although gay men are still at tremendous risk of violence in our society, I don't want to minimize that at all. But sometimes lesbians or queer women don't get the coverage that they could use, or they get taken as seriously for all of the work that they've done in the movement. Lesbians were huge in the AIDS movement, although we weren't as at risk nearly. We still don't have women in a lot of leadership positions, or leadership positions held by people who take lesbians as seriously as they could.
Dell says it's crucial to continue work that counterbalances the mainstream narrative of our history, which sometimes ostracizes gay people, and to make sure lesbians are given the same amount of recognition as men. This issue is one that writer Frank Rich recently explored with an article in New York Magazine about how lesbians have gone largely invisible in pop culture.
If he can't have me, I can't see my daughter.
What you're hearing is a trailer for the movie Carol. It was released last year and is based on a novel published in 1952 and authored by lesbian Patricia Highsmith. That novel is called The Price of Salt. Rich says many of the lesbians he talked to for the article say the book gave them examples of two women they could finally relate to. He writes, back then, and even in some ways today, quote, gay women often had to settle for the crumbs of mainstream culture. He says the book was notable for its happy ending. Other novels that mention lesbians at that time painted them as deranged and incapable of success.
This book, which didn't in any way present female homosexuality as pathological, really hit a chord with readers. And when it was published in paperback, it sold nearly 1 million copies.
Rich himself has worked on bringing female leads to the forefront. He's an executive producer for the television show Veep. It features Julia Louis-Dreyfus playing a character who is vice president and then eventually gets the top job. He says Hollywood has been slow to warm up to movies like Carol.
Lesbian culture has suffered in general, as female culture has, in places like Hollywood, because the city is essentially run by men, and some of them are straight men and some of them are gay men. They're all likely to favor their own stories over women's stories, whether the women are straight or gay.
Rich was the chief drama critic for the New York Times for several years, beginning in 1980. He says even there, for a time, he couldn't use the word gay in print. The history of discrimination against gay men and lesbians alike may seem foreign to some teenagers, but for those who live in certain areas of the country, they know all too well that being gay is still not seen as okay. That's the most important audience, Salvo says, there is for the Legacy Wall. Its first stop at a school is at Chicago State University, but he hopes it will travel to schools in neighboring states like Indiana and Kentucky, and then farther across the country. Salvo says many of the gay, bisexual, or transgender women depicted will have familiar names, like astronaut Sally Ride, but the project will delve into aspects of their lives that have been buried.
Somebody like Josephine Baker, who could easily just be regarded as a chanteuse from the Harlem Renaissance era, but then went on to help the French resistance under the Nazis during World War II and then became a civil rights icon.
He says his efforts over the past years have shown him the importance of intersectionality, a term you hear a lot in the feminist movement. It's about the ways our identities interplay and affect each other.
Every gender, every race, every class, every nationality, every religious faith, every orientation, every identity, every variation on the human genome that there is an LGBTQ component to it.
And it's no secret that for lesbians, the intersection of their identities as both gay and female can come with added burdens.
Men, gay or straight, are still men. And there's a degree of privilege that has gone along with that. Sometimes a minor degree, depending upon the culture, sometimes a major degree.
For those who see it, the Legacy Wall will make it clear that women are just as important to the LGBT community as men, a message many girls are still in need of hearing today. For 51%, I'm Rachel Otwell.
And for the 2015-2016 academic year, teens at San Francisco Unified School District School of the Arts walked into a brand new kind of class, the district's first ever LGBTQ studies class for high school students. Lee Zach Shallett reports for KALW's Cross Currents.
Meet Lindsay Schlacks, the teacher in room 204 at San Francisco's School of the Arts.
We're going to start talking about trans, not just transgender, but the big umbrella.
For the past 8 years, Ms. Schlacks has started the school day talking to her students about economics and U.S. government. This year, she's focusing on something different, the big umbrella of lesbian, gay, bi, transgender, and queer, or LGBTQ, studies. She's teaching one of the nation's first, if not the only, high school classes on the subject.
its history and its politics and government and its media awareness and its literature and its film. And so it's very, very, very interdisciplinary. There's a ton of art in here, a ton of poetry.
And a ton of videos, songs, films, podcasts, and TV shows, like Last Week Tonight with John Oliver.
This has clearly been a big week for the LGBT community, but it's also been a big year for the T part of that equation.
So we use a lot of, I use as much technology as I can to keep it relevant and interesting and engaging. We can watch old news reports. We can watch documentaries. There isn't yet a textbook for high school students about LGBTQ studies. So instead, they listen to all of these stories.
Schlacks actually crowdfunded for MP3 players this summer to make sure all her students could do the coursework. Things like watching this YouTube video of transgender activist Laverne Cox.
I'm an actress, I'm a producer, I'm a writer, I'm a daughter, I'm a sister, and I'm a transgender woman.
So you've probably heard of Laverne Cox at this point. She is one of the most vocal and the most visual trans activists out there.
Schlack says the class came about because the San Francisco School Board recognized the relevance of LGBTQ issues to its students. Like teenagers everywhere, many are grappling with sexual identity. Schlacks wants to make sure students hear from as many different voices as possible.
We're hoping to be able to have a Skype session with a film director later on in the year. And to make sure that the voices that are being heard in this class are not just mine, that they are the voices of the people who are a part of the LGBTQ community.
Many of those people live in San Francisco, so the students use the city as their classroom.
First, we're attending the Castro Museum, and then we're going to the new installation of the Tenderloin Museum about trans history in Compton's cafeteria.
That's Kira Monterosa, a senior with green streaks in her hair. She's talking about the Compton's cafeteria riot. It took place in 1966 at the corner of Taylor and Turk in the Tenderloin after police harassment of the restaurant's transgender clientele.
I think it's a really good way to recognize the history that we walk amongst every day.
Sophomore Izzy Vasquez, arms adorned with a serious collection of string bracelets, is thrilled to be learning about local events that paralleled national milestones in the fight for gay rights.
Well, and the whole Compton's cafeteria riot was so similar to what happened in Stonewall, which was the big movement. It was just really interesting to learn that San Francisco had so much history similar to the Stonewall movement. It was really cool to learn about that.
Senior Selena Wen is excited about classroom visits from longtime activists, like the former teacher who fought California's Proposition 6, which would have banned gay people from teaching in public schools.
We had, for the teachers, the bill against gay teachers, we actually had Tom...
A classmate jumps in to complete the sentence.
Tom Amiano, yeah.
He came in and talked to us about what it was like to be a teacher during the time when the bill was trying to get passed.
He was the first teacher in, I believe, the San Francisco Unified School District to come out as a gay teacher.
Amiano co-founded the No on Six campaign with Harvey Milk, San Francisco's first openly gay supervisor. Here's Milk in November 1978 announcing the measure's defeat.
A lot of people joined us and rejected Proposition 6, and now we owe them something. We owe them to continue the education campaign that took place. We must destroy the myths once and for all, shatter them.
3 weeks later, Milk was murdered in City Hall, along with San Francisco Mayor George Moscone.
And every time I walk by the Harvey Milk Civil Rights Academy, which was Douglas School when I first moved here in the early 1970s, it not only reminds me of Harvey, who I loved dearly, but also just what a wonderful symbol it is that a public grade school would be named after a gay rights hero.
Gay rights activist Cleve Jones has seen a lot of change since he arrived in San Francisco as a young man in the 70s.
When I was in school, of course, there was no such thing as a gay-straight alliance.
Jones was an aide to Harvey Milk and later created the AIDS Memorial Quilt. Today, he visits high schools all over the country And he says that talking about homosexuality with young people no longer raises eyebrows.
I really come from the last generation of homosexual people who, as we were coming of age, did not know that there were other people like us.
Back in the classroom, students are preparing a column for San Francisco's Bay Times newspaper, where they write on issues like being a good ally. Sophomore Izzy Vasquez says the class helps students validate their own experiences.
It's hard to feel empowered when you feel alone in what's going on in, with your struggle specifically and with your friends' struggles.
And senior Kira Monterosa feels like she's in the vanguard.
I feel like it's history in the making because it's something that's never been offered, and I didn't realize, like, with all the media attention, I didn't realize how rare it was to have this opportunity.
So, when the semester ends, what grade will these students give their teacher?
Definitely an A.
More than an A.
A plus 100.
Yeah, an A. She's doing a really great job and a really great thing.
San Francisco schools have changed a lot since the controversies over homosexuals in the classroom. And perhaps the fact that these students find nothing surprising about LGBTQ studies in their school marks the biggest change of all. In San Francisco, I'm Lizak Shalit for Cross Currents.
A new regulation protecting transgender New Yorkers from discrimination recently took effect. The change, which became effective in January, expands the state's existing anti-discrimination rules to prohibit discrimination against a transgender person when it comes to jobs, loans, schools, and public accommodations. The state already prohibits discrimination based on race, religion, disability, and gender. Governor Andrew Cuomo used his executive power last year to order the expansion after legislation that would have prohibited discrimination based on gender identity failed in the state Senate. 19 states and the District of Columbia already prohibit discrimination against transgender individuals. The tech world as we know it is male-dominated, with few females at the top. More women are adding terms like coder and game developer to their resumes. But as the Innovation Trail's Sasha Ann Simons reports from Buffalo, New York, the industry still has a long way to go to reach a level playing field.
So I'm inside a busy coffee shop on a Saturday morning, seeing all kinds of people. Some racing to get that first cup of Java, friends catching up. But I noticed a group of women in the corner, laptops open, and hardly anyone was speaking.
Time to get some work done.
That's Lena Levine, and she's the founder of the Buffalo chapter of Girl Develop It. It's a national nonprofit organization, and though it has a focus on women, anyone who's interested in coding and game development is welcome.
So we do a lot of beginner classes, like HTML, CSS, intro to the web concepts, intro to JavaScript.
Last year, women made up 22% of the people making video games. Doesn't sound too impressive, but according to a recent study by the International Game Developers Association, that was actually double the 11.5% of females in the field in 2009. It's taken us a while to get here. Elizabeth Canis is a member of Girl Develop It, and she says when she was a kid moving all the way from Columbia, South America to the Bronx, girls weren't into technology.
I didn't even know what technology was. No idea.
And when she thought she'd figured it out, she really hadn't.
When I decided I needed to choose a career, I'm like, I'm going to be a programmer. What I thought programming was learning Microsoft Word, Microsoft Excel, PowerPoint.
Being female in a male-dominated industry has been described as a double-edged sword. Eloise Oizon teaches game design and development at Rochester Institute of Technology.
We've made progress, but we still have a long way to go, a very long way to go. Now, the number of women who actually play games is 50%.
She's optimistic about the future of women in the industry, but isn't celebrating just yet.
The first woman in this situation, the first brown person in this situation, and all of a sudden you have to be not just competent, you have to be more than competent, you have to be super adjective, it is in that context, because you're representing everybody else.
Oizon remembers a time when breaking into the industry as a woman felt impossible. She says the barriers helped her develop a tough skin.
It sort of needs to be there in the front wave. That's the avant-garde. That's the front guard. But then the people who come behind, they're the ones who can sort of smooth things over, and then that's the point where things start getting synthesized.
Still, Girl Develop It trots forward. with more classes on coding, gaming, and mobile apps in the works.
After several years, it's going to, just the whole environment will improve. And once we get more women into the workforce, and we'll create more role models.
For the Innovation Trail, I'm Sasha Ann Simons.
Reporting by the Innovation Trail is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. For more, visit innovationtrail.org. A film director from the town of Big Stone Gap in Virginia had a homecoming like no other when she returned for the release of her new film. Lilia Fukin reports that the romantic comedy reveals a certain nostalgia for both the mountains and people of Big Stone Gap.
This is Ave Maria, the main character in the new film, Big Stone Gap.
I was born and raised in Big Stone Gap. Before I knew it, it was 1978 and I turned 40. I was the old maid.
Played by Ashley Judd, Ave Maria lives in a coal town in Virginia's Appalachian Mountains, where she struggles with love and life in a tiny town. To shoot the film, writer and director Adriana Trigiani came home to Big Stone Gap.
What brings me the biggest thrill is to see the kids I went to high school with acting alongside movie stars. You know, to see Whoopi Goldberg act alongside Ricky Wiles, who is the bachelor at the Pepsi-Cola plant in Norton, Virginia. I mean, come on, when is that going to happen in the world?
USA Today calls this best-selling author, director, screenwriter, and playwright one of the reigning queens of women's fiction. Adriana Trigiani is as funny and down-to-earth as she is smart and hardworking. She says that her rich Italian heritage shapes her work.
When I went to make this movie, I really went to make it like my grandmother would make a meal for 50 people. I kept thinking of them and how that they served people. I was in a service job as a director. I wasn't with a bullhorn and a cape, you know, I was serving people.
Trigiani admires that filmmaking these days usually employs a lot of computer-generated special effects.
You know, the beautiful special effects and all of the wizardry of it. You can have a monster come from Mars and you can put people in outer space and you can have them turn colors and you can have where there was one person in a stadium. You know, you used to have to really put people in the stadium when you shot Ben-Hur. Now you can just draw them in.
But because Trigiani wanted to make Big Stone Gap as true to the old mountains as she could, she decided not to use these kinds of special effects.
What I loved about making Big Stone Gap was that it was like they used to do it in the 30s, where you had real people. And the town of Big Stone Gap and the surrounding communities really rallied and came together and wanted to be part of the movie. So there's real people in it. And I am well aware that it's a movie that isn't made anymore. And good for us for that.
In the movie, Ave Maria suddenly discovers that she's not who she always thought she was. Her life in the tiny coal town turns topsy-turvy, and she even begins to plan a life-changing trip out of the mountains.
I knew I was telling a small story, but I had to give you the panoramic view of those mountains because you wanted her to leave them.
Trigiani herself left those mountains behind, and now she lives in New York City. But her love for some of the oldest mountains in the world runs deep.
There's a magic to those mountains, you know, where they become places where people can hide. And so there's a mysticism to them historically.
Though the mountains seem to almost be characters themselves in the film, Trigiani says that the heart of the movie lies in the communities of people that call those mountains home. For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Lilia Fukin.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at WAMC.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1387.